Welcome to Finding Joy with Kara. This is your host, Kara Kavensky. This episode is sponsored by Adam Gibson Design, an architectural design firm specializing in luxury homes. Full home design, remodels, and additions. The Adam Gibson Design team is known for an infusion of natural light, clean lines, warmth, efficient use of space, and most importantly, a healthy design. The Adam Gibson Design Team designs for living. Visit adamgibsondesign.com to learn more. Today, I am joined by Mike Green, cultural economist, consultant, speaker, and the chief strategist for the National Institute for Inclusive Competitiveness. And Mike, you're also the co-founder of Common Ground, Conversations on Race in America. Thank you, thank you, thank you for joining me today.
Appreciate the opportunity.
I would love for you to share your background and that you were somewhat fearless. And let's talk a little bit about those early experiences.
Well, I'm the oldest boy of five children, two brothers and two sisters. And my mother raised us in the 60s and 70s. In Houston, Texas. I was born in New Orleans, raised in Houston. And my dad left when my youngest brother was born. And so that left my mother with five children to raise in the 60s by herself. And if you've ever lived in the Deep South, and if you've ever been part of that culture of overt, in-your-face racism, well, you can imagine the kind of challenges we went through with my mother, who was a very light-skinned, what they called at that time a mulatto, very light-skinned Black woman with Creole roots, and my dad, light-skinned Black man whose mother was half Irish and a Black grandfather. So we were light-skinned kids, but we also had dark skin in our family. And that really, it was an issue. Dark skin and light skin in Black America within our community itself, much less the fact that we were all deemed less than, valued less than in the white communities that were surrounding where we lived in Houston. I grew up on the South Side, and it was tough because my mother was a very strict authoritarian. And even though wherever we went, there were always people watching us. We had that kind of communal family, and we walked to school every day back and forth. We had to deal with the streets, where as light-skinned kids, we were regarded as somewhat privileged in the eyes of others. And so that meant we were targets of attacks. On top of that, my mother refused to allow us to speak the language of the streets in our home. So we had to speak the King's English, the Queen's English, in her home. And my mother kept dictionaries. She kept books everywhere. And she was an avid reader. And she was a night owl, so she would stay up all night reading, so we couldn't wake up in the middle of the night and do anything because she was always awake. But if she always talked over our head. And anytime we didn't understand a word, she would tell us to get the dictionary. So all of that translated into the streets. And of course, if you're talking what was considered like a white boy, as I was accused of, and my brothers and sisters were accused of all the time, talking like a white boy, that drew the ire of the streets. So we were a close-knit family because we had to fight for our survival. We were always in fights. And we were always trying to defend ourselves and defend our Blackness, if you will, and the belonging. And so that attack from our own community, because of our lighter skin, because of the way we spoke, was an issue. And we learned to code switch early in our the boys were very athletic, so was my sisters. And so we not only did all the athletics, but I was a chess champion. So we were very versatile people. But my life changed at age 14 when my mother put me on a little yellow bus after I took a test that she encouraged me to take. And I was very competitive. So I wanted to win at everything, whether it was sports, whether it be chess, whether it be even acing an exam. I took the test and it said I was a gifted child. I didn't know anything about any of that, but it put me on a little yellow bus every summer to a science and math institute that took an hour to get to across town at a high school called Kincaid. That was a private school where wealthy white kids went. It's the first time I ever saw it. I just thought, wow, it blew my mind, because we turned off the highway and into a forest, and I didn't know where they were taking me. And then it opened up into this big clearing, and there it was with this huge college-looking campus, you know, and the angels singing. And it was like, wow, they're taking me here? And of course, to make a long story short, I learned more in those 2 years at the Science and Math Institute than I did in 4 years of high school. And one of the things that it taught me was that I lived in a world that was completely different and completely resource-less. That exposure and that proximity to what was being taught to other kids on a regular basis, it drew out of me a certain hostile attitude that I did not have before.
A sense of unfairness and wanting justice with equality.
Yes.
For kids. I mean, we're talking education, right?
Like, that's exactly the point. Why are they treating me and my peers differently than the peers of, you know, the white children that lived in different communities that I never got to see? At my high school, it was 99.9% Black. It was one white boy at our high school, and I knew him. Everybody knew him. Everybody knew the one white boy. At the end of the day, it was exasperating. It was frustrating. And I was angry not only at the other side of the tracks for having so much privilege, but I was angry at the people around me because they never told me this. They never exposed me to this. And so when I realized that I was growing up in two separate and unequal societies and I was on the wrong side of the tracks, and everything I learned, no matter what I learned, no matter how much I learned, and no matter the fact that I was getting straight A's, which I tried to hide from the kids in the streets so that, you know, they wouldn't get jealous or angry. That didn't matter, because those A's translated to C's and D's on the other side of the tracks. When I spent those 2 years at a science and math institute competing with other kids, I realized how little I knew.
Wow.
And I realized that the adults around me didn't know either. And it was the blind leading the blind. And I was angry. I remember age 15, I went to my mother and I said to her, "Mom, there's no one I can talk to." And to this day, and I'm 59 years old, and I still remember what she told me. She says, "I know."
Wow. That's powerful. So this was your big awakening moment at the inequity that existed in education. What did you do after you graduated from high school?
Well, I went on to the University of Houston, and you have to realize that my competitive spirit started back when I was 12. I'll just revert back really quick. When I didn't know how to swim and went to the public pool and went over to the diving board, I watched the kids jumping in the pool and swimming to the side. And I said, "They can do it. I can do it." That was my mindset. And no one ever told me any different. My mom certainly didn't tell me any different. It was whatever you see other people doing, you can do it as well. I jumped on the diving board and jumped into the 12 feet and realized at that point, I don't know how to swim, but I mimicked the kind of movements that I saw others doing, and I made it to the side. And I didn't have that fear that I would drown by doing something that I had never done before. When I left high school, I went to the University of Houston, and I was studying communications. And ultimately, after my first year, I joined the Navy. I took a test and qualified for the nuclear engineering. I didn't know what nuclear engineering was, but I knew that it was a ticket out of where I was. And they found out I was colorblind and said, you can't be a nuclear engineer and be colorblind. So I joined the Navy as a propulsion engineer. And they sent me to schools for engineering. And one school after another. And what they do in the military is when you pick a particular profession, they give you a deep dive. So all the extraneous stuff that you would learn in college, they strip all that away and they focus solely on engineering and the propulsion engineering. And I went through a full year of multiple schools in which I graduated either first or second in every single one. And I was the only Black person there. I was the only Black young man in any of these schools. And every time I graduated, every time I got second, I was, you know, it was like, oh, I just missed it. So that was what drew me in. And when I got out to the fleet in the military, a complete culture shock. My first ship, an amphibious assault ship carrying SEALs and Marines around the world. And I met them in the Philippines. They flew me out to the Philippines. Another culture shock. I remember when I was walking down the pier, I looked up at the flight deck, some 30 feet up in the air, and there was some guy peering over the edge and the sun was behind him, so he was silhouetted. And all I remember is him saying, "Who the hell'd you piss off to get on this piece of shit?" I said, "Well, welcome to the U.S. Navy."
Oh my gosh. That's a greeting.
But to his point, it was prescient, because for the first 2 years that I was out there, despite my advanced enlisted ranking, because of the schools that I had gone through, despite what the knowledge that I had learned, I was a messenger for 2 years. I had to go and just make coffee. And I was basically what they call a gopher. Go for this, go for that. And whatever the white boys wanted me to do, I had to do. And I spent a lot of time down in the bilges underneath the deck plates when they drop tools or they want me to go down there and clean or whatever. I spent a lot of time with water swashing over me, getting burnt on pipes. But while I was down there, I learned every system they had, every oil system, every fuel system, every water system. I learned all this. I buried my face in tech books every day, working 12 hours on, 12 hours off for 5 years. And what broke that for me was a devastating report by the engineers that they sent from Washington, D.C. during one of our refresher training exercises. They failed the ship. They said the ship was not battle ready, but they said there's one bright spot you have down there. They said, "Petty Officer Green, why is he still a messenger?" And I didn't know this was happening. This was up in the wardroom with the captain and all the various different folks from D.C. that after a week of putting us through all of the training exercises, they had asked me to take a messenger exam because I was a messenger. I took the exam. It gave me every test, including the supervisor's test. I aced every single one of those tests. And that was when my life changed in the Navy. I was told I had to go up and see the captain. They asked me about my experience on the ship. And they decided within the next 6 months to move me through all of the positions. And I became the first Black supervisor aboard that ship since 1969. And then I won Sailor of the Year. And then it went on from there. And I went to recruiting. I won every award there was in recruiting. My life just completely changed in the Navy. And I was celebrated rather than oppressed. You know, and then I spent 12 years in the Navy and came out to take care of my son. I was raising my son at the time and couldn't stay in the Navy any longer. And I wanted to write a book about what I had learned when I was recruiting for 4 years about the plight of young Black boys who I saw in 25 high schools, 2 colleges in southeastern Texas. In every school where I saw Black boys, whether it be a poor school or a rich school, out of 25 schools, they were all failing. They were all behind their peers. And it didn't matter their socioeconomic status. And I had the privilege of seeing them at home. I had the privilege of seeing their parents and speaking with their parents and enjoying dinner with them. I had the privilege of seeing them at school, at lunch, after school. And I had the privilege of seeing their scores and talking to their teachers and their counselors. So I had an overview of their lives that no single person in their lives, including their parents, had. And so piecing all these pieces together, and they formed a picture that was cohesive across the board. And I started taking notes, and I decided I was going to write about it when I got out of the Navy. And I didn't know anything about writing. I didn't know anything about media. And so I said, okay, here's another pool I have to jump into. And I went into a publisher's office in San Diego, and I told him, I said, I'll sweep your floors. I will empty your trash. You don't have to pay me. I just want to learn. He said, okay, that's an offer you can't refuse. 6 months later, he made me his editorial director. That started my media career. And then from there, he allowed me to create a crime prevention newspaper. I created an after-school program for at-risk youth in Southeast San Diego that won all sorts of awards. During my interviews, someone said, hey, have you ever thought about doing talk radio? I said, no, but I'll do it. Let's try it. So they gave me a show. I did a three-hour show every Saturday. It became the number one weekend show in San Diego for 2 years running. And that moved me into more media, weekly newspapers, then daily newspapers. I helped a weekly win awards to form a relationship with the LA Times. And ultimately, I ended up working with the Houston Chronicle and then for their competitors, the Houston Community Weekly News Network. And I won all sorts of awards and ultimately came out here to Oregon to get married and continued my media career with New York Times, CNN, Dow Jones. And finally left there and decided to go into tech entrepreneurship when part of my focus and part of my leadership in the newsroom was to bring print newsrooms kicking and screaming into the 21st society. And I did that successfully, but it was so hard. And I remember thinking after the last round of awards that I'm not going to do this anymore. And I left and decided to start my own tech company. And when I did, I learned about angel investing, venture capital. I also learned about what was happening across the country. And I wrote a series for the Huffington Post called The Innovation Crisis in Black America. That's when all hell broke loose. And people came to me from all over the country. And so I ended up shelving my tech company and creating a national consultancy. And that's when I became a cultural economist. And with Jonathan Holyfield, together, we formed a national consultancy that pioneered the ideology of inclusive competitiveness all the way back to my childhood and the competitive spirit. Well, Jonathan Holyfield was a former NFL player. So when you talk about competitiveness, he knows it at the elite level. And we both were focusing on economic competitiveness. Inclusive economic competitiveness. And so when we pioneered that, Jonathan ultimately went to the White House, became the director of the White House Initiative on HBCUs. He took the policies, the theories that we wrote about in our book, The Future Economy and Inclusive Competitiveness, how demographic trends and innovation can create prosperity for all Americans. He took those theories and he ingrained them in policy that ultimately Congress passed into a law that now all 32 federal agencies today are now having to answer to Congress every year. What is their HBCU competitiveness strategy, historically Black colleges and universities, and what their strategy is to increase the capacity of HBCUs to do their job. That being said, I then worked with Dr. Jamie Bracey Green on codifying those kinds of policies and theories into an operational impact on the ground. And so the Center for Inclusive Competitiveness was born at Temple University. We proved the concept and we grew it into a National Institute for Inclusive Competitiveness, where I am the chief strategist today.
Can you explain what your visions are to help with the systemic racism?
It's a great question. Let me tell you the mission of the National Institute for Inclusive Competitiveness, or known as the NIC. Our mission is simple. It's to increase the productivity of America's most vulnerable populations, the MVPs, by at least 1% GDP in one generation. Now that seems simple. Let's increase everyone's productivity by 1% GDP in one generation. And oh, by the way, if we do that at the very bottom, at the most vulnerable populations in this country, what's the impact? What's the generational impact of that for everybody? So, you know, the reduction of crime, the reduction of trauma, the pass down of generational wealth, or the accumulation of generational wealth, the increase in productivity in the workforce, the increase in productivity in the ownership of homes, ownership of lands, ownership of businesses that produce more jobs, ownership of intellectual property. So when we talk about equity in this country, we have to understand that equity from the very beginning of, from the inception of this country, has always meant ownership. That definition does not change when you put the word racial in front of it. It just means that the people who have been deprived, the people who have been denied, the people who have been systemically oppressed and targeted and kept out of the ownership equation now must be prioritized. And so their ability to access resources that lead to ownership of homes, lands, businesses, and intellectual property allows them to pass down that generational, that wealth to the next generation. Now, why should that be a priority? Not just an afterthought. It should be a priority because the entire wealth of this country was built on the backs of the most oppressed people in this country. And so when we think about some of the most oppressed people in this country, notwithstanding the natives from whom all of these lands were taken and they were systemically removed, out of sight, out of mind, the one question this country had to answer is about the people they could not remove, and that is what to do with Black people. And from the very beginning, the 13 colonies, before they became 13 states, had to decide and had to determine what to do with Black people as part of their character when they joined the Union. So states joined the Union as either slave or non-slave states. That was the character of the 13 colonies. And oh, by the way, when the United States was first formed, it was first formed by 8 slave states and 5 non-slave states. So the character of this country was as a slave-holding, so-called Christian nation with 13 colonies proclaiming this nation as theirs. That's how we started. There were no non-white citizens of the nation. There were non-white citizens of a state. And even then, they were treated less than their white counterparts. So at the end of the day, we're talking about a system that is rooted in the ideology of racial hierarchy, the valuing and devaluing of humans by race. This nation started as a white nation, devaluing all non-white people, with Black people at the very bottom, most considered property, not even humans. Okay? That's how we started.
Right.
All the systems of capitalization, capitalizing upon other people's weaknesses, not just opportunities, but capitalizing upon other people's weaknesses, keeping in mind the culture clash. When the Europeans first arrived, they clashed with the culture that had been here for millennia, which was shared lands and resources. They brought over here this ideology of ownership of lands and resources at the expense of humans and at the expense of human lives. So the most important element in capitalism is ownership. Lands, homes, businesses, and intellectual property, even if it means taking by force, even if it means killing other humans. That's the value system. And so all the way from 1776 to 1865, that was the value system.
And so then in 1865, we have 36 states. We have a civil war. and it's about slavery. And then we have the 13th Amendment, and then it's how do we incorporate these 4 million slaves into society? And that's a whole thing. So in changing this and in having steps that we can all be conscious of and use our vote, use resources that we have at stake, what does change look like to be able to fix this?
Okay, that's another great question. And you segued perfectly, because what we're trying to fix is exactly what they were trying to fix after the Civil War. The culture of this nation as a whites-only nation, as a whites-first, whites-centric nation that devalued all other non-whites, that was the problem after the Civil War, but it was exacerbated by the newly freed refugees from that war, 4 million newly freed Black people. And the question was, just like it was at the beginning, what are we going to do with all these Black people? The difference is that now you have those states that have seceded from Congress. So what's left in Congress are your individuals, your white male individuals who really wanted to do something to repair, to restore, to reconcile with the challenges of what to do with Black people. And so you had within that framework, white radicals, what they call white radicals. They call themselves white radicals. I'm not pinning that on them. The radical part was that they believed that Black people were equal to white people in all ways. That was a radical departure from the white supremacist ideology that had fueled and cemented the bedrock foundation of this country and fueled all the attitudes driving into the Civil War. So this idea by the white radicals that Black people were equal to white people in all ways meant to them that under the Homestead Act, that was giving away hundreds of millions of property and lands, that Black people deserved that as well. That's where your 40 acres and a mule came in, that Black people were promised when they were, after the Civil War, when they were part of the Freedmen's Bureau. So what white radicals did in less than 7 years, so we're not talking something that takes generations to do. We're talking 7 years. Here's what they did. They introduced the very first Civil Rights Act in 1866. Before that, they introduced the 13th Amendment, as you said, that told white people you could no longer own slaves. Did they fully close the door to that? No, they left it open for incarceration, which ended up having your Black codes, your convict leasing, and on and on and on, that ultimately instituted when they got back into power. But right now, at the time that we're talking, in 1865, they weren't in power. Congress had full autonomy to change the state of the nation, to change the systemic laws and policies. They weren't trying to change the people. They were trying to change the laws and create the conditions for the people to succeed. So they changed the 13th Amendment. Then they introduced a 14th Amendment that came out of the 1866 Civil Rights Act when the president, Lincoln, was assassinated and Andrew Johnson took his place. Andrew Johnson was a devout white supremacist. And so he fought against the Freedmen's Bureau, which was funded by Congress, and it was to provide education, clothing, food, job training, even a bank, so that the very first Freedmen's Savings and Trust. And who was the president? Frederick Douglass. So we're talking about a Congress that understood that the welcome mat for these newly freed Black people into a hostile white nation where they were not citizens had to be delivered by Congress. It had to be funded by Congress. It had to be overseen by the Secretary of War. The Freedmen's Bureau was overseen by the Secretary of War to provide protection for Black people from white people. This is not just white supremacists as we think of white supremacists as violent, ignorant. No, this was across the nation. These are ordinary white people who have been conditioned in their mind to believe in the ideology of white supremacy rooted in racial hierarchy. So they had to protect Black people from that and create the conditions for our success. So in 3 years, Civil Rights Act, three changes of the Constitution, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, giving us the right to vote. They prioritized the economic empowerment of Black people through the Freedmen's Bureau, and they funded it. So in prioritizing the economic and political empowerment of Black people, and ultimately having to face against their own president, they had to impeach Andrew Johnson in 1868, and immediately following that, extended citizenship to Black people through the 14th Amendment. That's why it was created. And then immediately after that, to create an opportunity for us to be represented in Congress with the 15th and the right to vote, which we're still fighting over to this day. So civil rights and the right to vote are the issues that Congress prioritized in 1865 to 1872 before the Amnesty Act came in and allowed the white supremacists back into Congress, and they defunded and destroyed everything. During that period of time, Black people, having conditions conducive for our success, began to build historically Black colleges and universities. For 100 years, we kept building them. We built more than 100. We began to build cities, whole towns, not just communities, but whole towns. In the first 20 years after the Civil War, we built 200 towns. We began to prosper and find ourselves with millionaires and find ourselves with the development of businesses and cultivate the talents that we already brought with us. We weren't just slaves. We were doctors. We were lawyers. We were teachers. We were all these people who were enslaved. And once you remove that condition from us and provided the conditions for our success, we did succeed. But ultimately, we went through another 100 years of white terrorism that tore down everything and took away our lands, took away our wealth, took away our lives. Until 1963, when Dr. King stood up and said in his I Have a Dream speech that we love to talk about, but we never talk about his reality. And that's where he started his speech with. And he said, 100 years later, the Negro is still not free. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still chained by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, and he went on with that refrain, telling the conditions of Black Americans 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation from 1863 to 1963. So he's saying, and when he ended that refrain, he said, and so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. Now, what does that mean? That means 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, the Black Americans were still within in conditions that were considered shameful. Well, we didn't start that way after we were freed. We started with the white radicals creating conditions for our success. And ultimately in 1872, the Amnesty Act, in 1877, the Great Compromise that pulled the troops away. And then by 1896, the Supreme Court said, we are two Americas, separate. One white, wealthy, and privileged, and the other poor, Black, and powerless. That's where we are today. That's the society we inherited. And you look at the number of businesses that Black people own today, exponentially more than we did when Dr. King died. But guess what? They still produce less than 1% GDP. 2.6 million Black-owned businesses producing less than 1% GDP. Segregation in schools still is as pronounced today as it was when Dr. King was alive. Access to capital, in the last 10 years, banks have been fined $243 billion for ongoing discriminatory practices that Dr. King decried back in the 1960s. So when Dr. King rose up during the 1960s with the Negro Revolution, which he wrote a book about called Why We Can't Wait. The very first chapter is called The Negro Revolution, Why 1963. We don't teach any of this in schools. We teach about the Civil Rights Movement. We don't teach about the Negro Revolution, which had three demands. in segregation in school, in discrimination in housing, and in discrimination in banking. We inherited all of those segregated and discriminatory practices to this very day. And I can't find very many people in power who can tell me what's the difference between a just and unjust law and where we can see those in today's policies and practices. And yet they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. In fact, the Black children in today's society, and I was one of them, are ubiquitously served by the worst quality schools in the world's richest nation. How is that not a campaign narrative, a campaign message every year throughout all the campaigns from the local, regional, state, and federal level? How come we're never hearing about that? We're talking about children.
Right. Well, and let's talk a little bit about the idea of having presence at the table for a long-term plan for cities. So you have just areas around, and we've heard really more recently in the last year, more front page news, more awareness coming into the American psyche on communities that were destroyed because a highway went through it, or homes were confiscated by eminent domain to put in something else and to develop. And then you've got gentrification, all kinds of issues around city development. But then you've got these pockets of poverty, essentially. And these are your most vulnerable populations that we're discussing. How do we give them a seat at the table to discuss incorporating and belonging in a plan to help them?
It's another great question. One of the problems we have here is that because all of our schools teach history, civics, economics, social studies through the lens of white supremacy.
Right.
So we're talking lies, distortions, propaganda, omissions. So when we have adults who grow up in this society, they take in positions of power, they sit in seats of power, and they don't have a lens that understands the damage, the generational trauma that was intentionally created and sustained generation after generation by white people, even well-meaning white people. They simply have been conditioned to believe the propaganda. The United States is a great meritocracy. It is the most benevolent nation on earth. It is the most Christian nation on earth. It is this, is that, and so on and so forth. And all the values, these, what they call American values. If you start actually looking at American values,
it's offensive. It's offensive.
It is. And so when we talk about public policies, the public policies and private sector practices have combined together to destroy Black wealth, to destroy Black access to resources, to destroy Black progress. So even the trickle of successes we have had is because of those people who have fought against a tide of systemic oppression. And some people have made it through with the help of white people. And then even then, when they have made it into an arena of marginal success, even then they find themselves shut out of other opportunities. They find themselves marginalized, even at an upper socioeconomic level. The masses, the greater masses, are kept in their place. And they're kept in their place by public policies. Let me give you an example. You talked about urban planning. Urban planning means one thing to white people. It means the raising of communities that are blighted. It means the development of new and improved and better conditions for white people. It is a privilege for white people. But when you start looking at the areas where they have raised communities, you will find almost ubiquitously that every Black community that existed in the 30s, 40s, 50s has freeways built over it, has been razed to the ground, the businesses destroyed, promises that were made that were never kept. And so the wealth of a community that was built up during Jim Crow, illegal segregation, was destroyed intentionally and deliberately by the federal government, state governments, and regional and local governments combined with private sectors. We're talking mortgage companies, we're talking real estate companies, we're talking economic development, community development, we're talking developers who are building homes, who built the suburbs for white people. That's a euphemism. Whenever someone says the suburbs, when they're talking about voting, they're talking about white people. That right. is the euphemism we use for white people in the suburbs.
And I just read an article yesterday about, it showed basically a heat map of sorts of trees and how the fewest trees are in Black neighborhoods, essentially, in neighborhoods with that are dominated population-wise by people of color and near factories and undesirable type of neighborhood-esque lands, that you need trees to be less stressed, to provide better air quality. And there's a big emotional and health component to having trees nearby. And there are some urban pocketed movements of planting more trees, and they will grow. Even, you know, they'll come up through cracks in sidewalks and things. Like, it doesn't take much to do this. It can happen if there isn't land, but there should be more parks and an entire community that's a little bit better planned with these type of green spaces.
Yes. And what you speak of are common sense, rational ideas. But we're not talking about common sense and rationality. We're talking about white supremacy. And we're talking about the hostility of white supremacy and the devaluing of humans. So you don't care if you build industrial sites right next to communities that are going to cause generations of cancer. You don't care if you put lead in pipes and what it's going to do to the brains of children. You don't care. Because these people's lives are devalued. You don't care if you raise their communities. You don't care if they don't have access to green spaces. You don't care if they don't have the kind of environmental protection that provides health or sustains health. And you don't care even if they have an adequate access to quality health, because you simply don't care about their lives. Now, when you talk about the devaluing of people's lives, Black people didn't just sit around and say, oh, woe is me. Oh, no. They raised their voices. In 1963, in nearly 1,000 cities, there were direct action, nonviolent protests that Dr. King writes eloquently and in detail about in his book, Why We Can't Wait. That began the Negro Revolution. Black people standing up, and this was the first time in U.S. history that so many Black people stood up at the same time in a nonviolent way all across this nation in nearly 1,000 cities. Now, that being said, by 1965, when you have so many Black people being killed, so many Black voices being killed, and so many white allies like JFK and others that have been killed, by 1965, you have this demonstration march in Selma that is met with force. A nonviolent march protesting the conditions, the lack of access to the polls, that is met with force in Selma, Alabama. By late 1965, you have the Watts riots. And when you have the Watts riots, you then have the governor in California commission a committee to find out what caused the Watts riots. Well, they came back and they said these systemic conditions, housing, lack of education, lack of access to resources, lower wage, lack of high unemployment, lack of opportunity. These systemic conditions that we know were in place, that we've been complaining about the whole time, that led from nonviolent to violent uprisings. Now, by the time you get to 1967, now you have 34 states and 164 cities that are experiencing violent upheavals by Black people protesting their conditions, their systemic conditions. So what happens in 1968? They commission another committee. The Kerner Commission comes back and says, these ghettos were established by white institutions. White society condones them and sustains them. So that's 1968. Now we now know that all of our ghettos around this country were intentionally planned. They were sustained by white institutions, white policymakers, and white people condoned it. Out of sight, out of mind. So they're now moved into the suburbs, and the blighted communities that are stripped of any resources are now the communities where Black people are basically economically quarantined, economically deprived, economically starved. And then, of course, you have police patrolling those regions, and the police are brutal. And so, and this is not new, they have been brutal from the time there have been police. And so now you have this oppressive community that is policed by an institution that is designed to protect white society from Black society. And so Black society, trying to sustain itself, trying to survive, is in a battle over scarcity. And so what is that? What do you do? You create laws that outlaw their activities. And then you have police arrest them and throw them in jail. And now you have this cycle of men and women going to jail. And then you get the schools involved. Remember, the schools ubiquitously serve the poorest communities with the poorest quality, meaning that they are stripped of any opportunity to compete in a rapidly evolving 21st century tech-based, globally competitive society, innovation economy that is fueled by a fourth industrial revolution that is accelerating the pace of obsolescence. These children do not have a chance of competing in this society. And so what ends up happening is they get into this cycle of being sent to detention, being sent to prison, come out of prison, you've got 84% recidivism rate. They now have another economy on the backs of Black people. Now, that being said, you know what they did in 1965? Congress, once again, Congress, not the states, but Congress introduced the EDA, the Economic Development Administration, and they funded it out of a public works infrastructure project. And here we are talking about infrastructure. That EDA, that Economic Development Administration, was designed to improve the economic conditions of the most distressed communities. That was their mandate. And what they did is they created and developed a infrastructure, a system of economic planning called Comprehensive Economic Development Strategies Plans, or SEDS, C-E-D-S, plans. And this blankets the nation. There are more than 600 of them across the nation that are produced by economic development districts and regional development organizations within those districts that produce the SEDS. They were designed initially and funded by Congress through the EDA, through the Department of Commerce and the Economic Development Administration, specifically to create plans and strategies to increase the economic productivity of the most distressed communities. Not one of them does that. Not one. And yet, they are created for a five-year horizon outlook. They're updated every year, and they create the conditions for regional prosperity in each region across the nation. And you know what? Kara, they work. They work. But they work for white people. That's why we now have a $22 trillion GDP, and we're the world's richest nation, and all these regions have prospered, and Black people have been left out of the plans, they've been left out of the strategies, they have been left out of the measures, they have been left out of the ownership of, or equitable ownership of, an American dream of prosperity. Black people are still behind, even when Congress prioritizes investment in our economic empowerment, it gets hijacked and gets used for other purposes. And to this day, we do not have an economic, comprehensive economic development strategies plan to improve the productivity of Black people in this country who are at the bottom of the economic ladder, as Dr. King wrote in his book. That being said, the NIC, the National Institute for Inclusive Competitiveness, is working on a comprehensive economic development strategies plan, region by region. That is what we want to do. That is what we're asking to be funded to do. That is what we want Congress and the states and the local regions to invest in the NIC to help work together with local communities and regions to develop a comprehensive economic development strategies plan or an auxiliary SEDS plan that prioritizes the productivity of Black people and the ownership of homes, lands, businesses that produce jobs, and intellectual property.
And we need it for everybody. Yes. So this is why we should all care.
Yes, Team USA consists of a multicultural society that, as you said, is going to be more multicultural than white, you know, in the next generation by mid-century. And so we need more of our team contributing more of their talent to the workforce and to entrepreneurial endeavors to bolster the global competitiveness of this country. Everybody benefits when the least among us are doing the very best that they can, because we've cultivated a system and an environment through which everybody can thrive.
I could not agree more, and you're absolutely right. And thank you for being with me today. And I am so grateful to know you. I am very grateful that you were able to come on my podcast. And thank you, Mike, for all that you're doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Joy with Kara. More information on the National Institute for Inclusive Competitiveness and on Mike Green can be found in the show notes for this podcast.